shuffle, step, shuffle, left, right, out. Shuffle, 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 jump, shuffle, 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 jump, on that heel, heel, straight, heel, toe, heel, that heel, heel, straight, heel, toe, heel, jump, shuffle, jump, toe, step.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Jane Lindholm. Today on Vermont Edition, we are going to explore the idea that dance is innate to all humans. And first, we're going to head to Bellows Falls, where a short documentary called Action Conversation Bellows Falls recently debuted in town. VPR's Susan Keith reports on an effort to use movement, body language, and words to bridge a generational disconnect in this small town.
The film begins by the Connecticut River on the ragged back edge of Bellows Falls. A young woman is jumping up and down, waving at the sky. Later, we learn that she's trying to flag down an airplane. Alexis Harris tells the story.
I never knew my real mom. Like, I knew that she lived in Florida, and I would stand outside with my suitcase, and they always said that if you, like, put your hands up like this, if you see an airplane, that they'll come down and they'll get you. Every time I would see one, I would stand out there and try to make them come down and get me.
Harris is one of five Bellows Falls teens and five older volunteers who came together at the Bellows Falls Opera House each day for 6 weeks in the summer of 2012. The younger women were from a summer employment program for low-income teens run by Youth Services of Windham County. The project was initiated by Vermont Performance Lab. The Guilford-based organization invites socially engaged performance artists to develop new work in Vermont communities. Visiting artist Victoria Marks, who led the sessions, teaches choreography at UCLA. Marks uses dance to create what she calls an action conversation between groups of people who might otherwise never meet.
When we start to move together, a lot of our elaborate, formal defense systems melt away a little bit, and we get to do things together that we may not be allowed to do when we sit across a table and have a conversation.
The film shows the women arriving at the theater in two distinct groups, older and younger. A message appears on screen. This project was created in response to a perceived gap between youth and adults in the small community of Bellows Falls, Vermont. The gap is evident in the conversations that follow. The older women seem eager to connect. The teens are wary at first.
People in your age group are the ones that are judging us.
Caitlin Tuller, a single mom, says a climate of disapproval makes it hard to wheel a baby carriage through town.
Adults will just, like, bash teenagers, really children, who were striving the most to be the best parent, and they can't because they really don't know how to be.
The film moves between conversations and choreographed vignettes developed by Marks from those conversations. In one, the women set up dollhouse furniture at the edge of a busy street. The flimsy plastic tables, beds, and chairs are buffeted and dwarfed by the passing traffic.
Throughout my childhood, we were homeless like 10 to 12 times, and we'd sleep on the streets. So since I was about six, I pretty much tried to take care of myself.
Many of the vignettes deal with ways of relating, touching and not touching, body language and looks that convey resentment, rejection, tenderness, affection. Alexis Harris found the physical interaction difficult at first.
I was a person who never got close to anybody. I didn't think I was ever going to feel comfortable with any of the people that were there, but throughout all of it, we definitely grew a really strong bond, all of us.
One of the challenges for the older women was meeting the teens on an equal footing.
I learned to kind of let go of expectations and just listen to what people had to say.
Kathy Michaels, one of the older women in the group, says that took time.
You know, I was just thinking, we'll give them all this advice, but that's not what they want. They don't want people to say, this is what I know, so this is how it should be for you, because their lives are very different.
But as they grew closer, the women discovered similarities in their lives as well. The bonds they formed during those 6 weeks showed when they came together again for the film's premiere. Vermont Performance Lab founder Sarah Coffey is making the documentary available to social service agencies. For VPR News, I'm Susan Keith.
The film is called Action Conversation, Bellows Falls. It was made by Los Angeles-based cinematographer Ann Kaneko, who filmed the entire six-week project. You can watch the film at the Vermont Performance Lab website, and you can find a link to that at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And now, let's dance. If my parents had had their way, they would have spent their lives dancing instead of working. They lived to waltz and polka. Their love of dance passed on to my sister, who danced from age 3 until she graduated from high school. After her classes, she tried to teach her brothers to plié, relevé, and tourjeté, and each summer we were required to attend her dance recitals. It wasn't until years later, when I took a woman to a performance of Romeo and Juliet by the Cincinnati Ballet, that I realized what all those dancers had been training for, and how powerful and athletic ballet and dance could be. And about 8 years ago, after winning dance lessons at a silent auction, I had my first opportunity to understand how transformative dance could be. I took 10 private tap lessons in a room above the co-op in Randolph. Today, we're going to discuss the beauty and the power of dance with Middlebury College dance professor Andrea Olson. She's also the author of a new book called The Place of Dance. Andrea Olson, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Rick.
So first of all, do we all have that innate desire to dance? Obviously, I do.
I think that dance is part of every person. And certainly as we want to have an embodied intelligence, we're reminded every time we walk outside with the trees and the water that we are nature too, and that the whole world is moving and dancing. That's part of our intrinsic intelligence. It's part of our birthright. So I'm glad you got to dance.
Well, I learned also to keep those ankles loose if you want to be a good tapper. Even those of us who are not particularly gifted in it, are we all dancers?
Well, as I say in The Place of Dance, one of my favorite things to do when I'm traveling is to ask people if they dance. And could I read you a short story from that?
I'd love it.
Okay. It's called Do You Dance? When I travel, I ask people about dance. Taxi drivers are particularly insightful. In Seattle, one asks where I am going. To South Korea, I respond to give a lecture and dance. I'm a dancer too, he says, from the former Soviet Union. I'll show you some moves. At the airport, he sets my bag down on the curb and begins a short routine with fancy footwork, quick turns, and polyrhythmic arm movements. Noting my delighted look, he adds, you'll do fine. You're a professional. And then I have a second one from Ecuador in the cloud forest in Mindo, Ecuador. Our young bird guide, Javier, says, all men dance in Ecuador. If you don't know how to lead, you'll never get a girlfriend. Our Galapagos guide, Washington, hosts a top deck dance party for our small group of academics. Trying to inspire a salsa flow, he partners us one by one. Downstairs, the boatmen are dancing. When the music stops, they are tying ropes and cooking dinner, living, dancing. And then the third one of my favorites, the passport inspector in London asks, what's your profession? Dancers often get a suspicious look, so I try professor of dance. That's fantastic, he responds. I do ballroom. If we all dance, the world might be a better place. So I've had a great time listening to people's response, and I'm often surprised how many people dance has been central to their life. And of course, it's partly how you define dance, whether you think of yourself as a professional dancer or as you think of someone who simply moves in a kind of quality.
I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, what does dance mean to you and why do you dance? You can share your thoughts and experiences by calling us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Now, when we think of dance, we tend to think of something kind of formal, following very specific steps. Is that too narrow a definition of dance?
Well, for me, because I teach both environmental studies and dance, I think of dance more in relation to nature. and that our movement is inherent. We don't have to create movement. We're participating in movement all the time. So that broadens the conversation quite a bit. And in fact, when I was writing this book, a colleague said, please don't use the word dance in your title because it leaves me out. She's a mover. You know, she does move. But when I asked another colleague about that, Lisa Nelson, a Vermont performer and international artist, she said, but dancing is what we do. Mm-hmm. So one definition is that the difference between moving and dancing is the quality of embodiment.
Wow.
So a lot of what I'm trying to work with in this book is encouraging that quality of embodiment that makes one feel that you're moving with every part of your body with an awareness that's both inner and outer, connecting to the environment inside the body and outside.
Well, I think, Andrea Olson, you'll enjoy this email that we got from Sebastian in Burlington. He writes, dance and movement were major aspects of the fabric of my home life growing up. Dance has the benefit of being physical as well as intellectual. Choreography can be almost mathematical in its creation and execution, and yet should have an emotional and artistic component as well. Creating a dance for others is a workout for both the left and right hemispheres of the brain. Performing in the dance of another choreographer is as close to spontaneous flight as I have ever been. So explain that cerebral side of dance for us.
Well, once when I was at a Harvard lecture on the brain, Dr. Saper said, right brain is about real time and real place, and left brain is abstraction of real time and real place. And I loved that description because it means that dancing or the right brain, rather than being, you know, often when someone's talking about creativity, they sort of wave their hand in the air as it's, though it's kind of flimsy and floaty. But what he was saying is that the experience of movement is in real time and real place, but your ability to choreograph it, to shape it, to write about it, as I've done in this book, to reflect on it, or if when you're improvising, to be shaping what you're doing in the moment, like we do when we walk down the street, if we're conscious about it, is really a partnering between right brain, left brain. So balance is what we're looking for, I would hope, in that process.
Well, I love the fact that you went to grad school for dance, but you chose that over history and biology. And I can safely say there aren't many people who decide between those three majors. So why did you choose dance?
I chose dance because it includes history and it includes biology. So I teach anatomy to both pre-med students and dancers. And I teach the history of dance in my introduction to dance class. And I get to create and perform. So there's something about dance which is inherently interdisciplinary. And I've always been very interested in the edge zone, or as we describe in environmental studies, that sort of ecotone of overlap between disciplines. And dance, because it's inherently interdisciplinary, the body is part of every discipline, is a way to stay engaged in the broader discourse of what it means to be human on the planet.
Excellent. Listeners, you can join the discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's speak with Belle in Waterbury. Belle, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's fun to listen to you and Andrea talk about this. This is a great topic. I just wanted to let you know about our experience here in Waterbury with a nonprofit dance studio called Green Mountain Performing Arts.
And tell us a little bit about that.
So Green Mountain Performing Arts is a great studio that started out as a private proprietorship back in 2006. And after the flood came in here, it washed out the studio, so we had to create a nonprofit to keep things going. And it's really been a great way to bring the community together, and the dance programs that we offer have been fantastic for the kids. And when Andrew was talking about integrated arts programs, we not only have classes at the studio in all genres, but we also try to get into the school and provide some after-school programming for the kids, too, and musical theater and the performing arts and just keep it really accessible mm-hmm. for them to just jump in mm-hmm. and feel the joy of music and dance and expressing themselves. And it's just been great.
And Belle, what does dance mean to you personally?
Me personally, I mean, I love to dance. I don't take classes, but the studio has meant a lot to my son, who started dancing at One Studio, which is what it used to be called, when he was 6 years old. And the enrollment grew there to like 400 kids, and he just got really into hip-hop dancing. And he really would just light up on the stage when he was dancing. And I just got, my husband and I just love watching all the kids. And then they stay with it, you know, for 6-7 years. It's just transformative.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Belle, thanks so much for sharing that. Andrea, we often think of dance as peripheral, you know, something we have to make time for, that we go and do. But you think of it as essential to our lives, to what it is to be human. So explain that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a little story about this. When I was finishing my first book, Body Stories, which is about the body, the anatomy of the body through stories, I went over to one of our biology professors and I said, "Oh, I love teaching about the body." And he said to me, "That's interesting. I spend all of my days trying to convince humans that we aren't the only species on Earth." So it was an opening toward my second work, which was the Body and Earth book, looking at the body in the context of place and how place affects our body. In fact, that we are place, that our bodies, our bones, breath, and blood are the minerals and air and water around us, that we're not separate from nature, but we are part of nature. And that interdisciplinary lens has really affected how I have shaped my own personal dancing as a performer as well as a teacher.
I want to share another email that we got, this one from Maxine from Montpelier, and she writes, "I started to dance when I was 5. Tap dancing was the thing to do in the 1930s, not ballet. The Rockettes of Radio City Music Hall were the stars. Then there was Shirley Temple and me. My oldest sister, Catherine, out of her meager earnings as a waitress in a local diner, paid 50 cents a week for my lessons. Somehow, she also found the money to buy the material for my costumes and pay a neighbor to make them. I'll be 85 years old in October, and I still love to dance. Once a week, I tutor a second grader who is from Haiti. We do math and other academic necessities, and then we tap dance." We're discussing why we dance, what it is we express through our movement. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page.
1-2-5-6-3-5-6-7. Hey, I'm Asan Nelson. I love the salsa dance because it helps you grow as a person. You build discipline. You're able to meet a lot of new people. It's very technical, and it's also just really beautiful. It's like an art.
My name is Shara Batson. I'm a junior at UVM. Other sorts of dancing, you do it on your own, or you'll battle against someone else. Here, you dance with someone, so you have that connection, that sensuality with someone else that you can share, and you create something really cool with that.
5-6-7. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're spending time tapping, twirling, and tangoing as we discuss the transformative power of dance. With me is Andrea Olson. She's a dance professor at Middlebury College and the author of The Place of Dance. And listeners, we want to hear what part dance plays in your life. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Andrea Olson, about 20 years ago, I attended a performance. It was a group called Ballet Africains. This is nearly 2 decades ago, but that performance still resonates in my mind like one of my favorite books or one of my favorite movies, maybe even more so. It was captivating. Why did it have such a hold on me?
Well, I think it's, Rick, it's always a surprise that we never really know what's going to touch us in our lives when we see a performance. It obviously triggered something in your own imagination about movement, also the rhythms and the the sort of inherent through the mirror neurons in your body you were dancing to. But there's also that sense of within your limbic brain, within the emotional brain, that if there's something stored in your memory with a particular emotional tag, it gets stored in a very particular way and place so that you remember something in great detail, like the person next to you or, you know, what the lights were doing or what you were wearing that day. So it sounds to me like it was an emotional memory for you as well as a physical experience of probably music and dancing with that particular ensemble, wouldn't you say?
It was. And I can still feel the pain in my arms from clapping so much because I've never seen anything like the power and the strength of these dancers. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely amazing. At what point in human civilization did we make that jump from movement to actual dances?
I think when there was the first cell about 3 billion years ago, because we're moving in the context of the larger planet. We co-evolve with the planet. So it seems like it's an emerging process that is inherent in our body. So it's interesting listening to Bell and from Waterbury talking about their group and that creativity was inherent in their choice to make a collective studio and respond to tragedy. I think dance can be celebratory, it can be spiritual, it can also really help us through moments of challenge in our life. It certainly has been that for me. It's a way of knowing what you feel is true.
Hmm. Let's take another call. We have Tyler calling from Bennington. Tyler, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having this conversation this morning. I'm just calling because I really do agree with what Andrea is saying, and I'm a dancer that just graduated from Bennington College. And so being thrown out into the world and sort of grappling with what being a dancer in the world means and going through that process, I really resonate with Andrea's words in terms of what dance can lend to a larger dialogue about participating in the world. And, you know, I always feel like dance is something that sort of chooses you. You know, if you look at the logistics of being a dancer, it's quite insane. But it's something I feel that, I don't know, for me personally, I feel like dance really has to come out of the studios a bit more. And, you know, so many things that dancers do can really, I think, lend themselves to, you know, the complexity that we're living in today. And so to sort of break the ideas of, you know, what dance is and to see how what dancers can bring to a larger conversation about participating in life.
Great comment. Andrea, how do we do that? How do we get dance out of the studio and out of a place where we go to dance and make it part of everyday life, as Tyler suggests?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of my goals is that dance looks normal anywhere instead of raising your arm in the street and everyone gets worried. So, you know, dancers know so much more than we think we know because we train so deeply in the intelligence of the body and space and creative response and improvisation so that, you know, if something isn't going one way in your life, you can shift and move it around. My husband, who was trained in sculpture, has learned this a lot in the environmental field where sometimes people get hit a roadblock, you know, when you're trying to make a project move forward. But in dance and in the arts, you've learned that a roadblock is just an invitation to trying something else. Mm. You just keep moving and exploring. But I also think that every dancer who has the skill and the comfort to be able to share what they know with other people, offer free lunch class, teach children, as Maxine was saying, find a way to bring movement into daily life in any way that feels right to you at any age as well.
In your book, Andrea Olson, you also talk about place and how important that is in dance. So how is dance different, say, in Vermont than it would be in New York City, for example?
Mm-hmm. It's been a an interesting investigation for me. I did a year-long project, a dance-a-day project, where I made a dance wherever I was, which means, you know, you stop in the kitchen and you say, okay, this is my dance today. Or you stand on the side of the road and this is the dance today, or in the Rocky Mountains or in Ecuador or in China. And how does it feel? Part of my question was, does it change how I move where I'm dancing? I know that it has changed who I am and how I move where I grew up. As a child in Illinois, running through the fields of the farm lands and seeing a 360-degree horizon was very different than doing graduate school in Utah, surrounded by mountains and feeling surprisingly claustrophobic in that beautiful landscape. So there's an impression, because it's a dialogue with place, that lands in your body where you are, whether it's in an urban setting or a rural setting, certainly. Mm-hmm. But there's also the fact that you're designing inside your body the space, you know, how close you keep your arms to your chest, or, you know, whether your spine's elongated. There's a kind of internal shaping of space. You're shaping the space around the body, which is very different in Italy than it is in Vermont, for example. Mm-hmm. How comfortable you feel being close to someone else. Mm-hmm. And then through space, and also in your imagination. Like, I can sit in this place that I am right now and be imagining myself, you know, walking across the east-west moraine trail in the Rocky Mountains. So there are a lot of dimensions that are affected by one's relationship to space and to place that are impacted by your dancing and also impact your dancing.
Well, as you talked about the dance of the day, it reminds me of how your book, The Place of Dance, is structured. So there are daily exercises, and then there are three parts in each exercise. First, thinking about movement, then moving, and then writing in a journal about it. So why did you take that approach in the book?
Because that's how I live. And that's what I want to share, is how one person has lived a life through dance. There's nothing in the book that that I haven't experienced myself, or in some way other artists, many interviews that are people that I've worked with or know. Mm. So basically, the first exercise is an embodiment or a somatic practice, so that you get a little more efficient in your own body, a little more flow. And then the second is an exercise or an invitation to make a dance or to dance somewhere that you are. And the third is a creative writing exercise. So hopefully after 31 days or a month of doing the book, you have a little smarter body and you have a dance that you've made or could share with someone else. And you also have a very rich writing life that's investigating some of these topics we're talking about right now.
Well, let's hear from a few more dancers. First of all, Darianne writes, "For me, dance is the expressive, sensual joy of moving with the music. It makes me feel happy, alive, and present in each moment. These days, I especially enjoy the warm embrace of Argentine tango and its beautiful music. I find myself smiling and laughing, enjoying the improvisational, kinetic conversation with my partner and the music. It's also fun to shed my Vermont flannels and put on some playful bling." And let's hear from Alan, who is calling from Morrisville. Alan, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
So tell us about dance in your life.
Well, dance for me is something, and I think the last caller, or what you just read from the person who wrote in on your page, was what I was about to say. That is an expression, really, of music for me, and I can give away my age a little bit by saying that I'm sure I was quite young when I learned my first dance, which must have been the twist. And I think since then, following along those lines, I come at it from a musician's perspective and as a teacher of music. And it's, you know, just feeling the beat, feeling the music, knowing the phrase. As I listen to your conversation, I've heard so many terms that dance, of course, shares with music. And I've always thought of it just as the physical expression through space to music's, you know, sound expression in time. Mm-hmm. And And I also was schooled in the Orff Schule work. And Karl Orff, who wrote Carmina Burana, most people know, was also a great music educator. And he worked with a woman named Gunald Keetman. And their whole thing was based on observing African tribes and cultures that grew up with motion and music totally entwined in the culture from day one, but without written accounts for this. And he came to the conclusion that we are all naturally moved to move, and it's based in speech and in rhythm, and of course, ultimately in our heartbeat. And I wonder if your guest maybe comment on how, in that regard, dance is different from, say, yoga.
Okay. Alan, let's give Andrea a chance to answer that question. Andrea Olson?
Mm-hmm. Dance and yoga, since I teach both and am fully immersed in both, it's a good question.
Yeah.
I also think, you know, just in relation to music and dance, which links to the yoga and dance, that in any good partnership, there's, you know, you have your own individual integrity, and then you have what's created with the two of you. And so in relation to music and dance, it does probably no richer relationship than working with live music, but also keeping the individuality of the music within the movement and the music by itself, really honoring that integrity. But with yoga, I think yoga is the union, of course, of body, mind, spirit is one way to describe it. It's channeling of energy. And as I work with, I teach in a yoga training program, and, you know, dance underlies yoga. Movement is the essence. It's the flow. And then as different cultural matrices create different forms that we get to experience that flow. And yoga is an amazing formulation of ways to channel energy through the body, hopefully to increase, again, our humanity. So there's definitely a partnership. I think that dance underlies. It's a broader terrain, and then yoga is a specific layering of that.
And Andrea Olson, where is interesting, exciting, important dance happening in Vermont or in our region?
In every corner, in every walkway, in every room. One of the reasons I love teaching at Middlebury College is that the students here are very smart, and they're very interested in physicality and the outdoors, the connection with the natural world. So if you bring those two together, which I think Vermont is a great landscape to explore that dimension, then you have dance all around you. Of course, there's also all the layers. When I write, I try to both address a broad audience and also the very serious professional dancer who has devoted their life to this pathway, this very rich pathway. So there's, you know, fine dance in the colleges and in the cities, but also site work and people doing interesting projects that are really based around the land.
Wonderful.
In all ages, it sounds like. Since we heard from Maxine, it sounds like it's different at every age.
So true. Andrea Olson is a dance professor at Middlebury College and the author of The Place of Dance. Thank you so much for joining us today on Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Rick.
And I want to leave with one more email, this from Rebecca in Huntington, who writes, I grew up in a small rural town in northwestern Pennsylvania. My mother enrolled my younger sister and I in ballet class at Mrs. Tarbell's house. The lessons were held in what would have been the family's living room. Mrs. Tarbell, a classically trained dancer, coached the girls. Boys dare not apply. Tapping us on the ankle occasionally with a different color cane depending upon the season. My sister did not last long, but I became a toe dancer. I loved every minute of it. In fact, although I am likely now the age Mrs. Tarbell was when she taught us, I think it's time to dance again. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. A symposium is underway today at the University of Vermont to look at how diseases spread, not just biologically, but socially, politically, and historically. The event brings together experts with diverse backgrounds, including anthropology, epidemiology, and medieval history. Jonah Steinberg is a UVM professor of anthropology and the organizer of the event, which is called 1,000 Ghost Maps. The name refers to a research project called the Ghost Map that examined a mid-1800s cholera outbreak in London. That work now serves as a model for understanding how political forces, cultural values, and disease pathology all contribute to how epidemics spread. And Steinberg told Jane Lindholm about why that multidisciplinary approach to illness fascinates him.
What I really love about it is the holistic approach to a single epidemic or outbreak, which is London's cholera epidemic of 1854. And I love the way he looks both at the way this drew in many aspects of society and then had implications for many realms, from city planning to physicians to everyday people. And I think it's too easy to separate out illness into its own category or domain and not think of it holistically as an element that involves and that has entailments for all of society.
Explain how a map of an epidemic can include more than just the details of the sickness. Because when you try to lay on history and cultural values and city planning, how does that all fit together?
You know, I think that maps are, at first glance, kind of restrictive. And one of the things that I always ask my students is to learn to read the atlas like you would read a novel. And so, you know, we see a map and we see topography. But a map contains so much more information and it hides so much more information. So a ghost map or a map of an epidemic, on the one hand, we might think that a map of illness alone only shows the details of the outbreak, but really the tentacles and tendrils of an event like an outbreak have to spread much further and wider than the map itself would suggest if we only took one discipline or one approach to the illness.
Stephen Johnson's book followed the cholera epidemic in the 1800s in London. How do you apply that to modern epidemics?
Well, I think all epidemics weave together in very complex tapestries a very wide array of social, political, and historical forces. And so a form of tyranny or slavery from 300 years ago can impact an individual life or a town or a home right now. And so those forms which seem disembodied, whether they are imperialism or oceanic empire, as we have seen it here in the Americas, or slavery, they are really not at all disembodied. They're embodied.
Can you pinpoint or describe an epidemic of some sort, you know, sort of drill down into a specific example?
Sure. I think the classic example is HIV/AIDS. You know, the restrictive map-like view of it might be that it's just a pathogen that spreads. But we see that it disproportionately affects poor people and people in areas that have long been dominated by other areas. And so the disease is also a feature or a piece of power. So we have history and social inequality converging in HIV/AIDS to reveal a very complex set of social dynamics. And I don't want to just restrict this to viruses. I also want to think about the wider webs that they're situated in. So, of course, malaria is tied to deforestation, but even beyond viruses, we can think about toxicology and, you know, exposures to lead and arsenic and mercury and the pathways of our own computers and phones to waste sites and their production at mines as something like pathogens that disproportionately affect poor people and people in poorer places.
So you're sort of looking at how a disease spreads not just by the pathogen spreading or a virus spreading, but how those pathways are created by factors beyond the illness itself, by either social pressure or group dynamics or culture or practices like agricultural practices that could lead to the way an illness travels through a population?
Absolutely. So if we look at, say, agricultural changes in India, which is my own area of work, we could maybe tie an illness to a set of conditions, including, for example, deforestation, the creation of new forms of irrigation and canals, the eradication of local seed varieties, the introduction of new seed varieties, pesticides, landlessness. And so a single illness, a hypothetical illness, could be tied to a huge variety of features. And then we could even extrapolate out from that landlessness and the pesticides and so on to British colonialism and to changes that happened 100, 200, 300 years ago. So the web is actually, or the map, as you said, is much wider than it appears to be.
Is it difficult to get an epidemiologist studying an outbreak right now and a historian who's looking at something that happened 300 years ago to connect and find their common ground, or how they might actually help each other in understanding these concepts?
I don't think it's difficult to get them to connect. I don't think it happens quite often enough. And that's something that is a big area of interest for me.
Well, how do you make that happen? I mean, you're not a matchmaker, really. How do you get these people to connect?
Well, I think you have to be a matchmaker. In current work that I'm developing in India, I'm actually trying to bring together chemists, environmental scientists, physicians, geographers, anthropologists, toxicologists, epidemiologists in one group to study the ways that scavengers or so-called waste collectors might move through a city on a given day and might be exposed to very harmful pathogens and toxins. And I think you have to come up with conceptual spaces like a grant or like a collection, a writing collection, or an actual room and put people in conversation with each other. So there is a kind of scholarly matchmaking that you can engage in.
And is that what you're aiming to do with this symposium that you've created?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm aiming to do, is to put all these people in one room and close the door and see what happens.
So is there a sense that using these methods could eventually lead us to how a disease might spread, so that we're actually able to intercede before it reaches epidemic proportions?
That is at the heart of the idea, I think. So a map is something that has three dimensions or four dimensions or a fifth dimension, which is observation. It's not just something that's spatial. It's something that has a dimension of time. And it's something that has observers looking from multiple vantage points and that has the participation of the affected people. So it's not just top-down. It's also bottom-up, and it's lateral. It's side-to-side, so that people are talking to each other in every way, and you have a real web work. We do actually have technologies nowadays that allows us to even draw conceptual maps in much more complex ways. Because when we recognize the patterns of the now and the patterns of the past and tendencies, we can make very good guesses at the future, where we have to sort of draw new interventions and roadblocks and open new doors.
Does this apply to your research at all? If I have it right, your research focuses on runaways in India, right? So does this apply?
Right. I started out looking in a more confined way at the social forces that drive children to leave home on their own in India, in particular without parental sanction. So these are runaways. But all of my time in India and Pakistan and Tajikistan and other places that I have done field work, I feel like my head was, you know, quite literally turned in this direction or forced in this direction, that people on the street who were maimed and mutilated and dying, literally dying before me or dead before me, forced me to ask this question more and more. And so when I returned from my last fieldwork period in India, I wanted to ask, what is it that's killing people in the same way or making them sick in the same way over and over again? And the suffering is often suffering of the body. Sometimes it's psychological suffering. But when I look at that, I see that historical and social forces are actually producing that. And those historical and social forces are often invisible to the person that they are striking, and they're often invisible to all the observers around them. But they are not abstract. They are everything but abstract. They are real embodiments of inequality and history and various forms of oppression on a person's life. And so somebody can literally be made sick or made depressed or killed by what appears to be a disembodied social force. When we look at a map of an epidemic, we need to look at the casualties as if they are able to speak to the still living. And as if they are able to speak to us, you know, to give us messages about what might have been done. So the map of an epidemic should be also about the still living and for the still living.
Professor Steinberg, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jonas Steinberg is a professor of anthropology at the University of Vermont. He's organized a symposium that's underway today that takes a multidisciplinary approach to understanding disease, and you can learn more online. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. That's it for today. Tomorrow, the state's process for approving energy projects from the citizens' perspective. When a wind project or gas pipeline is proposed nearby, affected landowners find they need to get a deep education on the regulatory process, and fast. Our guest tomorrow says there ought to be a less complicated and less expensive way for people to play a role in deciding where energy projects are located. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.